Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Happy to have hair in any color and join the club. This hotly contested trial lost its way when the district court allowed two government witnesses to call the defendant uncooperative, defensive, fraudulent, and suspicious in violation of her constitutional rights. It lost its way when the court admitted an incendiary recording that added nothing probative, and it lost its way when the district court admitted an order about a gun that defies explanation. The government kept choosing the road most prejudicial, resulting in errors that aren't harmless under any standard, let alone the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that governs the constitutional errors. To start with the first constitutional error, for over 40 years, applying Prescott, this court has not allowed the assertion of Fourth Amendment rights to be evidence of guilt, because doing so places an unfair burden on the exercise of those rights. Prescott requires reversal here based on two facts that are undisputed. First, that the government drew from its witness that the defendant was uncooperative with law enforcement, suspicious, displayed indications of fraud, the exact burden on the Fourth Amendment that was prohibited by Prescott, and it did so based only on her exercising her right not to allow the FBI to take fingerprints in her home without a warrant.
But counsel, with respect, correct me if I'm wrong, this assertion of a right occurred before she was even charged. Do you have any case law that suggests that asserting a constitutional right, if there is such a thing, before you're charged is a violation of Prescott?
Prescott itself asserted her right, or actually didn't literally assert it, but exercised it prior to being charged. She exercised it right when the, I think they were postal inspectors in that case, knocked on her door. No one had been charged. That was her first introduction at all to federal criminal law enforcement. One has a Fourth Amendment right to be secure in one's home, regardless of whether one's charged or not.
But counsel, you don't have a situation where a potential suspect is denying the police to do a warrantless search. The FBI is there investigating a possible burglary, who knows what. She's talking to an insurance adjuster. She says, this isn't a good time. Another time, it's the housekeeper is there. You know, she's not asserting her constitutional right. She's just saying this isn't a good time to do that. And the insurance adjuster is saying, look to me like she wasn't, you know, fully cooperating with the FBI. How is that an assertion of a constitutional right? That, you know, that's what permeates all the your arguments in this case. Judge Seaborg is an excellent trial judge, and he's dealing with a very difficult situation where your client is both trying to avoid discipline at work for having this totally inappropriate relationship with a prisoner and pursuing a burglary claim where she's not telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to anyone because of perhaps the same concerns about discipline for her inappropriate relationship. And whenever something comes up, you either put it over here and say it's a constitutional violation, or you put it over here and say, well, she was only doing that because of the underlying sheriff's investigation.
This is a constitutional violation. Prescott didn't expressly assert any rights either. What she did was just not open the door. And so what is really going on here is, and the explicit testimony of the government's witness was not just that she said she was busy, but that she was uncooperative, defensive, suspicious, an indicator of fraud. All of that suggests that everybody knew that this was a big deal, that she was not cooperating with the FBI. And the ultimate risk that Prescott focuses on is that conduct where you're not allowing the government to do what it wants to do, that you're protected by the Constitution to do, becomes evidence against you. And that is exactly what happened here. She did not allow the search. There's no question she didn't. The FBI asked her to take fingerprints and left without taking fingerprints. And the result of that, the result of her exercise of her important Fourth Amendment rights, was that she was declared, in effect, a guilty person, which is exactly...
With respect, I following up on Judge Lasnik's comment, I'm really struggling on this part of it, that somehow she was asserting a constitutional right. But let's say she was here. Rosen didn't testify to the search or the refusal. In addition to that, even if Rosen had testified that Myers refused consent to a search, his testimony would have been admitted for a proper purpose, because she'd asked them, to the FBI, to take fingerprints because she herself reported to be the victim of a crime. I just, like Judge Lasnik, I'm having difficulty squaring with what you're asserting here with a constitutional right. There are some cases, of course, that are really, really clear where there is a constitutional right, and the authorities are referring to that. But this really doesn't fit that, does it?
I think it does, Your Honor. And let me take, there were two different pieces of your question, and hopefully I can address them both.
Please.
First of all, it does burden the constitutional right because it went directly to what Prescott prohibits, that is the inference of guilt resulting from the conduct. If the court allows the government to just declare someone uncooperative, and that's okay because they didn't specifically mention fingerprints or whatever, then that's what the government can do in every case to get around Prescott. They can just skip the mention of the specific issue and go directly to the conclusion that the defendant was uncooperative, suspicious, and all these other terrible terms that apply.
No trial judge would allow that in most cases. You would never allow it to happen. But in this case, where she is accused of hiding information on the insurance claim, it changes the complexion completely.
Well, let me get to that, because I think that was also the other part of Judge Smith's question. And I don't think it is at all correct to use that justification. I respect that the facts that the court has noted, but that doesn't solve this Fourth Amendment problem. It doesn't for a couple of reasons. First, that's not how the government used this evidence. They did not use this evidence for a proper purpose. They used it to prove that she was defensive, uncooperative, and an indicator of fraud merely because she refused to let the FBI take fingerprints in her home. That's the Fourth Amendment violation. The notion that this would be okay as, well, since she was asserting a burglary, she should have consented to a search. That is actually prohibited by Prescott itself, which said, no, there's only one purpose of this evidence, and that's to infer guilt. But even apart from that, the repurposing from what they used it for at trial, say they're contradicting her defense, isn't right, because the way they're contradicting her defense is not based on, okay, in the case they cite, the Leavitt case, where the defendant said, hey, I was cooperative. She never said anything like that. This isn't a direct refutation of her defense. This is an attempt to refute her defense with the prohibited inference that had she been an innocent victim of a burglary, she would have consented to fingerprinting. And that's exactly what the Fourth Amendment and Prescott say the government is not allowed to do.
So, counsel, if I understand correctly, it's your position that if there is error here, it is strictly the constitutional error. You're not asserting a Rule 403 problem.
I think there would be a Rule 403 problem with this evidence, but you are correct, Your Honor. Our argument about this testimony is that it's a violation of Prescott and the Fourth Amendment. I do want to make sure I get to
you've got a minute and 16 seconds left before we hear from
eaten the sentencing argument. I did just want to say about the incendiary recording, we did make the proper objection. The judge acknowledged that in denying our post-trial motion. And I urge you to look at
This is the jail call?
Yes. Correct. I urge you to look at Judge Sergeant Ambat's testimony that shows that the government's incendiary recording was completely unnecessary. Ambat gave them at ER 1357 to 58 all of the facts that they ever needed or wanted. The incendiary recording was just completely prejudicial. And now I've run into Mr. Noller's time, so let me stop and let him talk.
Very well. Okay, so you'll have 4 minutes when we get back to you. So Mr. Noller, you get a new clock for 3 minutes. Let's make certain our, there we go. Make certain our court has that for you. Very well. Okay, please proceed, Mr. Noller.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Matthew Noller for Ms. April Myres. Ms. Myres was the victim of a burglary in which she suffered more than $57,000 in legitimate losses covered by her insurance policy. Yet because her insurance claim also included roughly $9,500 of unrecoverable losses, the district court sentenced her as though she had fabricated the entire $67,000 claim. But that decision was wrong as a matter of law, and it effectively doubled Ms. Myres' sentence, which is why the government doesn't even try to argue that the error was harmless.
Let's assume, arguendo, that some of the insurance claim was fraudulent. What amount of loss did the district court find that Myres was intended to cause?
The district court found that Ms. Myres intended to cause $67,000 in loss, the full amount of her insurance claim, including amounts that, as the record currently stands, no one disputes that Ms. Myres was entitled to receive in the absence of any fraud. And that's the problem, is that this court has held in the Hicks decision and the Berger decision that a district court may enhance a defendant's sentence based only on losses that, quote, resulted from the defendant's fraud. And that requires a but-for causal connection between the fraud and the loss. And so as the First, Third, Fourth, and Fifth Circuits have all held, a district court's calculation of actual or intended loss can't include any payments that the defendant would have been entitled to receive in the absence of fraud. And here at sentencing, and again before this court, the government hasn't denied that in the absence of fraud, Ms. Myres would have been entitled to receive at least $57,400 for the losses that she legitimately suffered.
But that's in the absence of fraud. There was fraud here. Even if she was the victim of a burglary, she did not cooperate as required in the insurance policy with the investigation of the burglary and committed fraud in that way, didn't she?
So in some respects, we're assuming that to be true for the purposes of the sentencing argument. But what in the absence of fraud means, Your Honor, is in order for there to be a but-for causal connection between the fraud and the loss, you have to ask what would have happened if there hadn't been any fraud. And then you have to compare that to what happened in the world with fraud. And it's the difference between what would have happened in those two scenarios that sets the upper limit of loss. And so what you have to look at is what would Ms. Myres have been entitled to receive if she hadn't committed any fraud at all? And nobody denies at this point in the case that in that situation, she would have been entitled to receive at least $57,400. That amount can't be included in intended loss. The district court erred by including it, and in so doing, effectively doubled Ms. Myres' sentence.
Okay, your time is up. Let me ask my colleagues whether either has questions of Mr. Noller.
I'm fine, thank you.
I'm good.
Very well. Thank you, Your Honor. We'll hear from Mr. Shepherd again on remand. I mean, on remand, on rebuttal, excuse me. And let's hear now from the United States, Mr. Mazur.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Ross Mazur, and I represent the United States of America. The evidence presented here over a week-long trial showed that the defendant was a law enforcement officer who filed a fraudulent insurance claim for items that included her service weapon and other sheriff's department-issued equipment. The evidence of fraud was overwhelming, and its sufficiency is not challenged on appeal. All of the disputed evidentiary questions were thoroughly briefed, argued, and correctly decided below, and the district court did not clearly err when it found that the amount of intended loss was the face value of the insurance claim.
Counsel, what, without specific factual findings from the district court, how can we determine that Myers purportedly or purposefully sought to cause losses equivalent to the total amount of her insurance claim?
I think that the district court's calculation was correct for two reasons, Your Honor. The first, I would refer to the court to the decision we discussed in our brief, United States v. Torlai, where this court found no need even to reach an almost identical claim that the district court's loss calculation included both legitimate and illegitimate losses. That was because Torlai failed to comply with the claims procedure for showing that the loss he suffered was even caused by a covered event.
But the same, isn't it clear, though, that the district court has to determine what she intended to cause?
Yes, the district court has to determine what Myers, the amount of loss she intended to cause.
And where in the record did he do that?
Well, the district court heard extensive argument on this and reviewed the party's extensive briefing, and it concluded, at the sentencing hearing, that the omissions and the lies associated with her claim were included in the fraud.
But again, I understand that. But my understanding, unless you can show me that I'm mistaken, is that the law requires the judge to specifically find what her intent was, what she intended the amount of the fraud to be, basically. And I don't see that in the record. The fine judge, but I think in this case, perhaps she needed to do a little bit more in terms of the specific factual findings. Where am I wrong?
Well, I think that the defense argument here about the amount that Myers purposely sought to inflict misapplies a distinction. And I would refer the court to the key case that the defense relies on in the sentencing context, which is U.S. v. Manitou, the 10th Circuit decision authored by then-Judge Gorsuch. But Myers takes the distinction in that case between knowledge and purpose out of context. In there, the defendant was caught after stealing and cashing two convenience checks for $1,800. But the district court found an amount of loss of $10,000, which was the credit limit and the amount that theoretically the defendant could have written in on the checks. And what the 10th Circuit said was that even though that amount might have been theoretically possible, there was just no evidence of that the defendant intended to cause that much loss. The situation would be analogous here if the government had argued that the limit on Myers's insurance policy, $1 million or whatever it may have been, was the amount of the loss, but not the amount of the claim she actually submitted. So I think that the distinction that the defense draws between purpose and knowledge doesn't apply on the facts of this case. And moreover, as in Torlai, this court found no need even to reach the issue of whether particular items were legitimate or illegitimate. It simply said that because the defendant failed to comply at the outset with the claims procedure for showing that the loss she suffered was caused by a covered event, that the court didn't need to look any further. And that reasoning applies here as well. Myers failed to answer basic questions about how the loss occurred. Did she suspect anyone? When was the last time someone had been at her house? Who was she living with? And by not answering those questions, she didn't even let the insurance company determine whether this kind of loss was caused by a covered event. And so as in Torlai, the court need look no further. And in that regard, I think the district court's findings were not necessary.
So your position is the district judge made all the findings he needed to and on an appropriate basis?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And alternatively, even if the court were to consider Myers's argument that some of the losses were legitimate and some were illegitimate, which the government doesn't believe is accurate, but even if the court were to consider that argument, In this court's decision in Popo, which we cite on page 57 of our brief, the court held that the amount billed to the insurer may constitute prima facie evidence of intended loss for sentencing purposes. And in Alfas, which the defense strongly relies on, the First Circuit held that in a case like this one, where it's almost impossible to separate what might be fraudulent from what might not be fraudulent, where the claim is rife with fraud, then a sentencing court may use the face value of the insurance claim as the starting point for computing loss.
What is your response to Mr. Noller's point that you can include payments that the defendant was entitled to into receiving the absence of fraud in the calculation of the intended loss?
My response is that test doesn't apply here because it was Myris's fraud itself that prevents us from knowing what she would have been entitled to in the absence of fraud. Her fraud hid every aspect of what happened, of the events surrounding the burglary. And so there's no way to engage in that counterfactual about what she might have been entitled to. However, to the extent that we can ask that question, I believe that the defense position is that Fowler committed a burglary on his own. But Fowler was living with Myris at least until the day before the burglary occurred, and Myris's insurance policy specifically disclaimed any coverage for a loss that was caused by someone who regularly resided at the insured location. And so for that reason, even were the court to consider some portion of the claim as legitimate, Myris would not have been entitled to any insurance coverage.
Well, that may be, but we're talking here about the amount of the loss for purposes of her sentencing. So it seems like your position is if the amount of the insurance policy, we'll just round it up to say $70,000. Let's say that legitimately, she would have been entitled to get back $60,000 because she actually lost $60,000 that was covered by the policy. Is it the government's argument that in that situation, the amount of the loss would be $70,000?
In ordinarily, no. I think that I agree with Your Honor that the general rule is that when it is possible to segregate the legitimate and illegitimate portions of the loss amount is only the illegitimate portions, the fraudulent portions. But in this case, the entire claim was fraudulent. It wasn't only. There's no way to separate the legitimate from the illegitimate items.
So your argument here is that my hypothetical is kind of irrelevant because in this case, there was no legitimate recovery on her part under any circumstances. The entire claim was fraudulent because she would not have been entitled to one red cent from the insurance company. Is that correct?
Well, I would never call Your Honor's hypothetical irrelevant, but yes, I agree that that is the government's position, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'd like to respond just very briefly to some of the evidentiary claims that my colleague discussed. Myris's Prescott claim fails for three reasons. The first is that she never asserted her Fourth Amendment rights so as to trigger any protection under Prescott. When the agents asked to take fingerprints, she didn't say no. She said not now. And when they came back the next day, she had more reasons why it was still a bad time. And the reason, she did that deliberately so as to preserve the appearance of cooperation. This court should not hear her to claim the protection of a right that she never invoked. But secondly, the Prescott claim fails for the reason the district court found below, which is that the government just never mentioned a search request, let alone commented on a refusal to consent to one. And I think that the testimony here is important. In Prescott, the court held that it was wrong for the government to argue that Prescott's refusal to allow warrantless entry into her residence was proof of guilt. In this case, an insurance adjuster was asked whether he remembered any statements that Myris made to the FBI agents during the brief part of the conversation that he overheard. And what he testified was that they had asked her to do something. He said, I can't remember what it was, but she basically said she didn't have time and she had to work with me. And that's on page 963 of the record. In this case, the testimony wasn't sanitized. The insurance adjuster didn't mention a search request simply because he didn't remember one. And so the case doesn't implicate any of the thornier constitutional questions that potentially may have arisen if a different witness had been in a position to talk about a specific search request. What distinguishes this case, as Judge Smith alluded to, from the Prescott case and from most other cases, is that law enforcement was not investigating Myris of a crime. It was investigating a crime that Myris had reported. However, if this court were inclined to rule more broadly, which the government would invite it to consider, it could hold that even if the insurance adjuster had testified specifically that Myris refused consent for a warrantless search, that testimony would have been admissible under the exception to the Prescott rule, which this court recognized in Levitt v. Arave, and which other courts have also recognized, because in Levitt, the testimony was admissible because it directly refuted the claim at trial that the defendant had been cooperative. Here, the testimony would have been admissible because it directly refuted the claims that Myers was the victim of a burglary and that she did not know who the perpetrator was until almost a year later. Other than that, I would only assert that while the district court's rulings were all correct, any error would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the overwhelming evidence of fraud. Unless the panel has any questions, the government would respectfully ask that you affirm the conviction and sentence.
Very well. Any questions by my colleagues?
We're going fine, thank you.
Good too, thank you.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Mazur. Okay, so Mr. Shepherd, you've got 4 minutes.
Thank you for indulging us, Your Honor. And if I could ask for one more bit of indulgence, since so many of the court's questions were about the sentencing issue, I'd like to just briefly address the evidentiary issues and then cede the remainder of my time. Would that be permissible?
Talk about whatever you want, including indulgence. That might be interesting.
I'd like to cede the remainder of my time after I briefly address these issues to Mr. Noller.
That's fine. You've got the time. You can divide it up as you wish.
Appreciate it, Your Honor. First of all, let me just briefly touch on the claim that the evidence was overwhelming. The government keeps saying that, but we responded in our briefs and showed why we had a credible answer to every piece of evidence they offered. Plus, we had several instances of showing that the jury would mistrust the government's proof because it blew up in their face on a number of occasions. They never respond to any of that. They just keep saying the proof was overwhelming. If it was, they would have had a response to our arguments. Addressing Prescott, Prescott did not claim her Fourth Amendment right either. In fact, she testified that she wasn't objecting and not letting the officers in based on the Fourth Amendment. But she got her Fourth Amendment protections anyway, because that's what the Fourth Amendment is all about. It doesn't matter who's being investigated. Prescott wasn't being investigated herself either. It doesn't matter who's being investigated. One has those rights to protect their own home. And the fact that the search request was not mentioned, if the government can just skip that, Prescott becomes a dead letter. And look at these facts and what Rosen testified, not just that she gave an excuse, but that she was agitated, defensive, that she was an indicator of fraud, that she was uncooperative. The jury wasn't going to think that that was the FBI asking for help on a weather forecast. They knew that that was something really important. And that's where the constitutional rights get triggered. And this is not a case like Levitt, because this was not a direct refutation of a claim of cooperation. This was an argument based on the prohibited inference that if she were innocent, she would have allowed the search. And I'll yield the remainder of my time to Mr. Noller. Thanks for the court's indulgence.
Thank you. Mr. Noller, I want to ask you a question right off the bat. Your opposing counsel says that since the entire claim was fraudulent, that your analogy doesn't work. What's your response to that?
So they keep saying entire claim was fraudulent, and I think it's important to break out what they mean by that. because the government did not argue to the district court and has not submitted any evidence that Ms. Myris did not suffer a large number of compensable losses under the insurance policy. So when they say entire claim is fraudulent, what they mean is that in their view, Ms. Myris didn't provide the full truth to the insurance investigators and lied about some facts. Now, we disagree with their account of the facts, but the bottom line is that the government does not contend that if she had told the truth about everything they say she lied about, she would have been entitled to a payment from Farmers Insurance of roughly $57,000. And so this isn't—
Does Farmers Insurance point to anything in its policy that says, hey, her claim is totally fraudulent? Did they say we owe her $57,000?
No, they didn't find that, but they haven't said the opposite. And if I could address your point about the factual findings, the district court didn't make any factual findings beyond a finding that Ms. Myris committed some amount of fraud. It didn't find which lies it was relying on. It didn't find anything with respect to Ms. Myris's intent to cause $67,000 in loss with respect to any of those lies. And it didn't find that in the absence of those lies, Ms. Myris would have been entitled to nothing. The government now cites this regularly residing language in the policy. It never cited that to the district court. That argument has been waived. And at a minimum, that would require a remand to analyze the meaning of that language as applied to these facts.
Okay, your time is up. Let me ask my colleague whether either has additional questions for Mr. Noller or Mr. Shepherd, for that matter. Any questions?
I'm fine, thank you.
I would just like to ask about the guideline range. You talk about it subjected her to double the punishment, but the range of level with 12 to 18 months, and what you were asking for would be 4 to 10 months. Isn't that true?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the
judge could choose 10 months versus 14 months, and we'd be arguing about basically 4 months.
That's possible, Your Honor. The reason, and that's a question for remand. The reason I say double is that I think the district court made pretty clear he thought a mid-range sentence was appropriate. A mid-range sentence in the 4 to 10 range is 7 months, which is half of the 14 months that he sentenced Ms. Myris to.
Well, as someone who has sentenced literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people in my 32 years on the bench, you know, we say things about a mid-range when the range is here that we might not say mid-range if the range was there. But it doesn't go to the basis of your legal arguments, but I was just pointing out that it might be the difference between a top of a range of 10 months and a bottom of a range of 12 months. Thanks, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, thanks to all counsel in this case. The case of U.S. versus Myers is submitted.